The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by an historian of British colonialism, the British Empire and the British Isles. His first book, The Interest, How the British Establishment Resisted the Abolition of Slavery, was shortlisted for the Orwell Prize for Political Writing. His latest, Impossible Monsters, Dinosaurs, Darwin and the War Between Science and Religion, is the story of the discovery of the dinosaurs and how it upended our understanding of the origins of the world. He's a fierce quizzer, champion on University Challenge in 2015 and a finalist in the 2018 series of the BBC's Mastermind. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Michael Taylor.
Thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, at the start of Inspired Minds, we always ask people about inspiration, what inspires you, about what it means to you as a concept. What is inspiration to you?
That's probably, you know, you've just mentioned my quizzing history, and that's probably the most difficult question I've ever been asked. When it comes to an inspiration for writing, I really find that I need to be deeply interested in the subject matter. You mentioned my first book there, which was about the abolition of slavery. This book is about the discovery of dinosaurs, and a lot of people might think that's an enormous leap. But really, I take inspiration from the period and sort of the intellectual context in which both of those books are set. As I begin writing a third book, which will be about the conspiracy theories of the French Revolution, I'm beginning to realize that what really interests me and inspires me is this period in the end of the 18th century and the first half of the 19th century, where in various ways, people and institutions and movements are reacting to various forms of the Enlightenment. So we find a kind of moral and political enlightenment in terms of the campaign to abolish slavery. We see a greater exploration of the natural world and what that means for man's relationship to the world and his relationship to God in this book about dinosaurs. And then the purely political institutional aspects of that same change in terms of the French Revolution. So this is a period where I think we can see the modern world emerging as we now know it. There are ideas about society, about politics, about science, about religion, about communities that are coalescing and crystallizing in this time, and that continue to have a relevance for everything that we do and say and think today.
Is it partly the chaos of it all? Reading your book, what strikes me is the speed of change, the way that people's minds in their own lifetimes would have to come to terms with completely different thinking. And is that not necessarily unique to this period? Because as we move into the 20th century and 21st century, brains are being scrambled all over the place with different notions. But this seems to be a particularly fast and furious period of intellectual change.
It does. And in terms of paying tribute to another one of my inspirations, one of my mentors, a historian at Cambridge called Boyd Hilton, argued that a man could go to sleep in 1780 and wake up in maybe 1830 and not much had changed. But by the time you get to 1840 or 1850, the world as he might have known it had undergone a complete revolution. This is the period in which there is a rise of secular egalitarianism in the French Enlightenment. The rise of democracy, the secularization of society, the industrialization of economies, especially in Britain. So not just physically, but intellectually, the world by 1840 or 1850 was completely different from anything that had gone before, certainly by 1770 or 1780. And although historians of earlier periods will probably hate me for saying this, there is a break in continuity around this time, towards the end of the 18th century and the early 19th century, which I think really does separate what we might regard as modernity from everything else that goes before.
Is that a charge that could be leveled at the 20th century? You know, I think about someone like my grandfather, born in the first decade of the 20th century and died in the last decade of the 20th century. We sort of focus quite a lot there on technological change. You know, he would have been used to a horse and cart when he was a child, and then suddenly man and woman is flying into space, nuclear bombs as opposed to trench warfare. What that does to the mind. Are these sort of as analogous periods?
I think so. I mean, there's a great joke that does the rounds on Twitter about Karl Marx coming back from the dead, and socialists begin to ask him, look, is this the kind of, you know, social democracy that you had imagined in your manifesto? And his only answer is, you guys went to the moon? So there is this idea that the kind of rapid technological change that took place, especially in the middle part of the 20th century, also marks another cleavage with the past.
But I guess the difference here is that technological change, you can sort of get your head round. I mean, the difference here is we're talking about intellectual change and a fundamental change in understanding of where we as the human race has come from. And I want to take us back to, you said from 1780 to 1830, nothing might have changed. And a big character in your writing, in a way, is James Usher and his famous identification of the start date of the Earth, which to us now seems so laughably ludicrous, isn't it? The 23rd of October at like noon or something utterly crazy. And I want to ask you about that, because firstly, of course, you're from Northern Ireland. James Usher's from Northern Ireland. Is that partly what draws you to this guy and to that as a sort of jumping off point?
Usher was from Dublin, but he became famous as the Archbishop of Armagh. It's not necessarily what drew me into it, but the idea that we could calculate the age of the Earth by reference to biblical history, to the histories of Greece and Persia and Rome, might sound completely ridiculous to us now. But for the time, that was an incredibly sophisticated bit of scholarship. So Usher, hated polite company, hated really the clerical aspects of his job. But what he really appreciated was the money that he could raise from his episcopal diocese that he could spend on gathering in all of these books from Rome and Berlin and Aleppo and Constantinople, which allowed him to pursue this chronology, as he called it, of the Earth's history. And he pieces it together in a really painstaking fashion. It takes him decades to do this. And so he pegs certain events at certain dates, like Alexander the Great defeating the Persians, the raising of Jerusalem by the Babylonians, and subsequently the exile. And then we get into all of those verses where X begets Y begets Z, and he adds up all of the ages of all the patriarchs and comes to this date, the night of 22nd, 23rd October, 4004 BC, which is a Saturday because he believed that everything would have begun on a Sunday, because obviously the Sabbath, Saturday in Judaism, which is where he's working at the time. And yeah, I've said it could be ridiculed, but really for a very long time, that was one of the better guesses that anybody had ever made. And it becomes such a pronounced feature in the Anglophone world, because whenever the King James Bible is printed more widely towards the end of the 17th and through the 18th centuries, they decide to put dates on it. And the date they put beside the first verse, the first chapter of Genesis, is 4004 BC. Now, that's not the case to say that everybody believed this adamantly. Lots of other people had tried to calculate the age of the Earth, and they had got slightly different, slightly longer dates. And certainly, whenever we come into the high period of the Age of Enlightenment in the later 18th century, you have people like the Scottish traveller Patrick Bryden, who's walking on Etna in Sicily, and he's seeing the lava flow and cool and harden. And he realizes the rate at which that's happening, and realizes that really we need a lot more time than 4,000 years or 4,000 years BC for that kind of process to take place. James Hutton's a Scottish geologist, and he in the 1790s puts forward this potentially sacrilegious idea that really there's no vestige of the beginnings of time. So these people are laying the groundwork for the period that I study in this book, which begins with Mary Anning's discovery of fossils in Dorset in 1811 and 1812, and then quickly goes on to look at the geology that Charles Lyell propounds, which is to say that we have a much older Earth than the Usher chronology would allow. And Lyell, for the first time, manages to put forward this idea in a way that is acceptable to conservative mindsets and that is easily comprehensible to the average man who might be reading it. And so the combination of the growth of these sciences of paleontology and of geology then begin to bleed into natural studies of life itself, into the zoology and the natural history that people like Darwin and Richard Owen are studying, and then the kind of thing that Thomas Huxley takes up the cudgel with later in the century. So the book is an intermingling of all of these stories, and I've tried to tell it all together, which I think is the first time that somebody has tried to do this, and to try to tell the story within the broader context of society. It's not simply the case, despite what the subtitle says, of a permanent eternal warfare between these great monoliths of science and religion. It's about two competing ways of looking at the world interacting with each other within the grand sweep of Victorian history.
So I want to take you back to geology, because it seems so crucial, but also so unusual from a modern perspective, because there's thousands of years of intellectual thought before the 1780s. You know, the Greeks obsessing over mathematics and philosophy and art, and to a degree religion, I guess. So around the world at this time, were there no sort of, you know, geologists of the past that people could refer to? I mean, there were still stratifications of rock that were visible. Were they never really appreciated as layer upon layer upon layer of history and prehistory?
Not to the same extent. So we have being practiced primitive forms of geology. I mean, there is lots of geology before the Age of Revolution, although they would not necessarily describe it as geology. It was often cast in terms of mineralogy. So what's in the earth? What can I use that's in the earth? To what industrial or economic ends can I put the land that I own? And you mentioned stratification. That's something that William Smith, who's often dubbed, you know, the father of English geology, made into a science. He could tell that depending on what occurred on somebody's land and at what level, he could predict with absolute certainty what would be beneath it. This was an incredibly valuable skill to have because you could probably work out whether or not there was coal on your land and therefore whether it was economically worthwhile to sink a mine. Really, you know, it's not until the 1810s that geology begins to flourish. There had been the Geological Society of London. That was more of a dining club than anything else. Of course, there were scientific papers and there were serious discussions, but it's not until 1819 that Oxford founds its first lectureship in geology. And that title and that lectureship goes to William Buckland, who is another, you know, he's a clerical gentleman. He's somebody who believes devotedly in Christianity. He's an Anglican minister. All Oxford Dons are pretty much Anglican ministers at this stage. And he sees no real conflict between studying the earth and studying the Bible and practicing Christianity. He's practicing a tradition of what might be known as Paleian theology. So William Paley was an English cleric who thought that natural theology meant that explorations of the world were means of revealing the works of the Lord. And people like Buckland and William Conybeare and even Mary Anning are all operating within this tradition, where even though the evidence of the earth may not be straightforwardly supportive of a biblical history of the world, and it's not, for them it's quite easy to reconcile these things together. Although the very process of reconciliation, and this is an argument that I make in the book, does presuppose some kind of latent tension.
So is the tendency so strong towards a literal reading of the Bible that it's sort of forcing discovery through the lens of that Bible, read literally? Because of course, to the modern eye, we find it very easy to imagine, you know, Anglicanism appears to take the Bible more as a sort of series of metaphors and suggestions and has no problem with this at all. So were Protestants in the 18th century still kind of wedded to the Bible as a literal historical source text?
Some certainly were, and it's quite easy, I think, to reflect that extremism and to project that kind of extremism onto the entire communion. The natural philosophers, the learned scientists, as they would become, were by this stage already well aware that certain early parts of the Bible could well be metaphors. But these are the kinds of conversations that are happening within cloisters of scientific societies and Oxbridge colleges, and certainly a lot in Paris and other places around the world. But it's not necessarily the case that the vast number of British Christians or Christians anywhere would have given a second thought. They didn't necessarily have any means of knowing that the Bible was untrue. But whenever we get into the 19th century and we have not only evidence of the earth making it explicitly clear that the Bible is junk in terms of the history of the earth, we have a lot of theological criticism coming in from Germany. We have fairly radical, daring textual deconstructions of the Bible being undertaken by German thinkers, being translated into English by people like George Eliot. And they're pulling apart the Bible as you would pull apart any other kind of book. They're stripping it of the mystique and the majesty of it being a divine revelation. And they're looking at a book that had been written several thousand years ago for specific purposes and which would reflect the very human concerns of its authors. Now, whenever in 1860, seven Anglican clergymen do their own version of this in a collection called Essays and Reviews, this is one of the great controversies of the Victorian age. A couple of years later, there's an Anglican bishop of Natal in South Africa called John William Colenso. And he is trying to translate the early books of the Bible into Zulu so he can use them in his missionary work. And whenever he does this work, whenever he deconstructs the Hebrew and the Greek and the Latin and goes through it word by word, line by line, he realizes that he can't actually, in good conscience, preach this stuff to the people that he's trying to convert because none of it makes an awful lot of sense. And he is pilloried for this. The very first convocation of the Lambeth Conference happens in order to censure and to discipline Colenso. So there is this world in which if a scientist says one thing which could be sacrilegious to another scientist, that is nowhere near as dangerous as it would be for an Anglican bishop or a prominent member of the Anglican Church to make the same kind of comment.
I'm going to come to Mary Anning shortly because I think this is the next point I would like to get to. But just before we do, notions of the origins of the world in other countries, because your focus here is very much on Europe, the European world and the academic discourse within that. Was there any sort of influence at all coming from the Far East, from China or the Middle East, where you've got very different religious traditions? And indeed, what attempts are being made in other parts of the world to sort of identify the age of the earth?
There have been attempts, or there had been attempts, certainly in China, in sort of what we would regard as the Middle Ages, if not late antiquity, to try and date the earth. There had been attempts to do so in ancient Greece. For the most part, however, this is a Eurocentric and even an Anglocentric story, at least in the way that I've told it, and that might be a mistake to do so. I'm not trying to deliberately exclude different ways of understanding the world or different approaches to the natural history of the earth, but I think it's fair to say that much of the really and literally groundbreaking work that's being done in this period is happening in Britain, and that's, you know, not a jingoistic nationalist take on the story. It is the case simply that Britain has an awful lot of the sedimentary rocks which allow for this kind of analysis, the sedimentary rocks which trap dinosaur fossils. You know, it's just good luck for British scientists and British paleontologists, not only that dinosaurs lived there, but the rocks preserve these fossils. And at the same time, you have the world's most industrialized country where there is workers are laying down the largest sort of lengths of railway lines. They're driving the most number of canals through this landscape. So there is a commercial and industrial interest in churning up the earth, which is yielding all of these fossils. And for these reasons, besides the point that Britain is the leading country in the world at this stage, and therefore the British opinion might matter just a little bit more, there are a number of factors which necessarily draw the historian to places like London and Oxford and, of course, Paris, and then later to the German universities. That's not to say that this is the first time that anybody had really done this or studied it, but it's the first time where these things had coalesced into a really important scientific movement. I should say that there had been stories and reports of dinosaurs and other fossils from the Middle East and from the Silk Roads, as Peter Frankopan has written about, dating back into antiquity, because we look at the mythological monsters of Greek history, you know, serpents, dragons, chimera, griffins. They were almost certainly dinosaur fossils that people had seen trapped and preserved in the hot, dusty landscapes of Central Asia, and of which reports had made their way back into the Mediterranean.
So let's head to Mary Anning, because she is sort of, she's selling seashells on the seashore, of course, but that seashore is the Jurassic coast, I presume, where you've got this particularly sort of large concentration. So firstly, let's focus on Anning herself, because her story is starting to become a little more familiar. As a child, I didn't grow up really knowing her, but now, you can't really watch an episode of Antiques Road Trip that goes to Dorset without mention of Mary Anning, which is, I guess you're going to tell me, a long overdue adjustment to her place in the historical record.
Yeah, I think we've made that adjustment. I think you could say maybe 20 or 30 years ago, there had been a failure to recognize the scientific contributions that she had made. But certainly over the past 10 or 15 years, there have been a slew of biographies of Mary Anning. There's even a film starring Kate Winslet about her life. It's fair to say that during her lifetime, she certainly did not reap the financial rewards or generally receive the scientific recognition that she was due because, one, for a number of reasons, really. I mean, she is a relatively poor, uneducated in terms of formal education woman living in a coastal town in Britain. So whereas people like Buckland and even the Sussex surgeon Gideon Mantell, but certainly other people like Darwin, Huxley, Owen could find their way and make their way in London and in polite society, that wasn't really ever open to Mary Anning. So she could find all of these incredible fossils. So the Ichthyosaurus in 1811 with her brother, the Plesiosaurus in 1823, the Dimorphodon a little bit later. And she was in constant contact and correspondence with people like Buckland and Roderick Murchison, who was a really important figure in geology at the time. And they well knew that if they wanted to find some of the best fossils in Britain, they would go down to Lyme Regis and they would consult her. But it was their names on the papers that were published. They were the ones making these findings or presenting these findings in person to the Geological Society and to the Royal Society, and they would exploit her. She was a resource to be used rather than a genuine partner in scientific investigation. And her life ends in sadness, really, in poverty and in pain. And although some tributes are paid to her at the moment of her death, I think it's fair to say that she was obscured and excluded from the place that she deserved. Certainly in 1831, 1832, whenever the great naturalists of the country are founding and developing the British Association for the Advancement of Science, they have a real and serious debate about whether or not to invite women of any description to their meetings. So you have somebody like Mary Somerville, who gives her name to the Oxford College, is an incredibly eminent physicist and mathematician. She's translating all of these great works of European science into English, and she's not invited. People like Buckland think that this would really just distract the men from the serious business to which they were to attend, and that the presence of women would turn their meetings into the soirees of Albemarle Street dilettantes, as he puts it. They do, in the end, invite polite ladies to attend the conversaziones and the dinners that they hold. They don't extend any invitation at all to Mary Anning, and that's a matter of class.
I mean, this seems obviously extraordinary to the modern ear, but I guess might there also have been an element of, being aware, if you were getting lots of information from women, your information might almost be discredited by the fact that it's been discovered by women. Is there a sort of degree to which, the men are having to sort of cover this up? Or is it all really just sort of self-serving, misogynistic, dismissive?
It's not actively misogynistic. I think that's important to say. There is just an assumption that it would be the man who would take the credit and the man who would make these findings public. And it's not just with Mary Anning. So even William Buckland's wife, Mary, plays an incredibly important role in his work. There's one anecdote, whether it's true or not, I'm not entirely sure, but Buckland's trying to work out which animal could possibly have left the fossilized footprints that he's discovered. And his wife happens upon the idea of kneading out a slab of dough and then placing the family's tortoise on the dough, and the footprints match, and hey presto. She also serves as his factotum. So he is dictating everything, and she is actually the one who's writing it. With Gideon Mantell, who discovers the Iguanodon in Sussex in the 1820s, again, this is a little bit disputed, and Mantell, for somebody who kept extensive diaries, doesn't actually record the moment of discovery, but it is said that it's actually his wife, Mary Mantell, who makes the first discovery of the fossils, which lead to the discovery of the Iguanodon. Charlotte Murchison, who's the wife of Roderick Murchison, the geologist, she also plays an incredibly important role whenever he and Charles Lyell are exploring the volcanic landscapes of French Auvergne. So there is a recognition that women are making important contributions, but I think those contributions are often completely subsumed by the societal persona and prestige of their husbands.
So let's move now into the 20s, 30s as these discoveries are being made. And that's into the backdrop, remembering where we first started here, that, if you wake up in 1830, not much has changed from 1780, and yet fossils are starting to be discovered. So what are the kind of intellectual loops that people have to go to explain these creatures that, don't appear on the ark, as far as we're aware, appear to be extinct? How do they get explained away by people who fiercely want to stay to a rigid notion of 4004 BC or similar for the creation of the Earth?
Well, first, to add a little bit of context to this period of the late 1820s and early 1830s, things are beginning to change really quite rapidly. So In terms of British politics and civil rights in 1828, the legislation which affects Protestant dissenters is finally and formally repealed. The next year, in 1829, Catholic emancipation takes place. So for the first time, Catholics can take a full part in British public life since really the Glorious Revolution. You then have the next year a Tory government falling apart. So the Tories had basically been in power for 58 and a half of the last 60 years. By the next year, you have a Whig government that is pushing through the cause of parliamentary reform, which eventually happens in 1832. The year after that, you have the abolition of slavery. So this is what one historian has called the fall of the Ancien Régime. The way that Britain looked and felt and operated politically and in terms of public life has changed dramatically in the course of only 5 years. This is also the time when Charles Lyell is publishing his ideas about geology, which give the most eloquent and the most persuasive expression to the idea of an older Earth that had ever really come about. And so by the 1830s, by the middle of the 1830s, you can have somebody like Charles Darwin, who's on the Beagle, going around the world looking at the evidence of this profound geological change and the evidence of slight variations and adaptations of animals in South America. And coincidentally, Darwin was also a fervent abolitionist, so he's very part of the intellectual tumult of this period. But now he has the intellectual toolkit and the evidence with which he can begin to piece together the ideas which eventually evolve into what he describes as natural selection.
So is this a slight license that's now being given in a way because of the intellectual and political backdrop?
It's both a means of empowering the people to have these ideas. But yes, there is a degree of license. I mean, we need to remember that there could be severe penalties for alleged or attempted heresy or anything that is perceived to be heretical. So in the 1810s, in the wake of the French Revolutionary Wars, people could still be prosecuted and were prosecuted for seditious blasphemy for publishing the works of Tom Paine. The Age of Reason was damned and was effectively an illegal book. You could be pilloried for translating Voltaire, put in the pillories for translating Voltaire into English, and there's an elderly schoolmaster who dies in the pillory because he's been punished for doing so. There is a professor of Hebrew at Oxford University, Henry Hart Milman, who publishes in 1829 a history of the Israelites that basically rubbishes the Bible as a source of historical evidence. And he's effectively ruined his career by doing so. So there are really severe penalties for stepping over the line. But what all of these political and social changes and then the ideas that people like Lyell are putting forward is, as you say, not just providing a license, but also intellectual weapons with which people like Darwin and a younger generation can attack the orthodoxy of the old order.
So now Darwin's out there, and we sort of associate him more with the theory of evolution, but has that come hand in glove with the discovery of the dinosaurs? It seems to me that they're still slightly separated, aren't they?
They are. No, that's a very fair point. And in the first edition of The Origin of Species, where he sets out his theory of evolution by natural selection, although he doesn't use the word evolution by that stage, he concedes that the greatest weakness in his theory is the absence of a fossil record to provide evidence for his theory. That changes fairly dramatically in the 1860s with a number of discoveries on both sides of the Atlantic. So first, in Bavaria, you have the discovery of the Archaeopteryx, which I'm sure everybody will have an image in their head of it. It's, you know, the feathered reptile, the dinosaur bird. Elsewhere in Bavaria, they find the Compsognathus, which is a small, lithe, chicken-like dinosaur. And in the United States, which is beginning to become one of the royal frontiers of global paleontology, we have the discovery of the Hadrosaurus, which, whenever it's put together, people like Folk and Leidy, who are the paleontologists studying it, realize that it had to walk on two legs. In other words, it had to stand like a bird. They also find birds with teeth, or fossil birds with teeth. So putting all of these things together, people like Huxley and these paleontologists are realizing that there is a connection between dinosaurs, between modern reptiles and birds. And we know today that birds are in fact dinosaurs. So when all of these things come together, it's Huxley who does this and who makes this incredible speech at the Royal Institution in the presence of Richard Owen, who really despised the whole idea of adaptations in species without divine intervention. He says, if you believe in evolution, you're going to have to look at these dinosaurs, you look at the way they stand, you look at their proximity to modern birds, and you can say, in a way that avoids much of the controversy that would apply to comparing other primates with humans, evolution's real. look at the connections through time, through thousands, if not millions of years, between all of these different types of creature, the way that their legs, their hips, their stance, they are, if not the same, definitely related to one another.
So what is the fundamental theological challenge here? Because we know that people can make the shift from seeing the Bible as an historic, factual source for the start of creation, but then they can perhaps sort of allow their minds to adapt ever so slightly. But there's a more fundamental theological challenge, isn't there, to the notion of adaptation of species beyond just, you know, now Noah clearly couldn't have put a brontosaurus on the ark, for example.
One of the major objections is simply that evolution by natural selection is chaos. It's not a divinely ordered progression of species. It's not necessarily an improvement of species. So people often look at the phrase survival of the fittest and think, oh, it's the best, it's the strongest animal that will survive. It's not. It's the creature which is most fitted to the challenging circumstances in which he finds himself. And then that puts the emphasis back on the word survival. You know, this is not unchallenged progress through natural history. This is a fight for scarce resources. And so the idea that this is the mechanism driving the natural world without any kind of divine supervision or intervention is in itself quite challenging. Of course, the idea that the creatures could actually change in their constitution over time is also offensive, because it presupposes that the Lord, if he was indeed involved at the moment of creation, had made mistakes. So what could be more heretical than saying that whenever the Lord made all of these creatures, he made so many mistakes that there would be millions of years of improvements on what the Lord had done? And this was actually why the very term dinosaurs was a political football when Richard Owen coined it in 1841. He despised that idea, and he despised any theory of evolution or natural change where the Lord was absent. But his argument was that if all of these dinosaurs had existed at the start of time, as they knew it, if the most stupendous and complex and sophisticated reptilians ever known were there at the beginning, then it would mean that these theories of progressive development were rubbish, because if the best things were at the start and were absent today, then he thought that would implode the entire notion of evolution.
I mean, that is such a remarkable place for a brain to find itself when we look back with what we know. But presumably at that time, that was the logical conclusion you had to reach from your starting point. Everything seems to come from that starting point. And because what you're describing here is actually a rapid advance in our understanding. So that kind of friction must have been very real and very tempestuous to be able to make the changes such that, you know, by the 20th century, it's really not controversial at all to imagine still a creator, but allied with the notion of free will, then, you know, once God's put things on the planet, if you want to look at it like that, then he's done his job. And then it's up to all the other species to get on and do what they do. And, you know, they may adapt. We don't have a problem with that at all. Obviously, that tension is so immense. And yet it plays out so very rapidly.
It does. And there is still a danger inherent in these ideas, or at least in expressing these ideas. Darwin had formed a lot of his theory by the end of the 1830s. But this is a Victorian gentleman who, even if he loses faith in God whenever his daughter dies in 1850-51, is still terrified of losing his own personal respectability. And he thinks this could well happen if he expresses these ideas and if he is damned as the devil's chaplain, as he put it. Because he had been present at the Geological Society when a former mentor of his, the Scottish zoologist Robert Grant, and he is, we think, the first person, first Briton to use the term evolution, had been goaded, deliberately goaded, into suggesting that the possum could have evolved from ancient reptiles. And whenever this happens in front of, you know, the cream of London Scientific Society and several members of the government, he is derided. His career is effectively ended because he has put forward this profane notion of change within the natural world. You know, there's a very good reason that it takes Darwin more than 20 years, really, to find the gall and the bravery and the confidence in order to publish his ideas in their entirety. And he's only really pushed into this because in 1858, Alfred Russel Wallace, who's a fairly penniless but very gifted collector and analyst of the natural world, who'd spent a decade in Brazil and has now spent the best part of another decade in the Dutch East Indies, has come up with a strikingly similar idea completely independently and sends it to Darwin and says, you know, what do you think about this? And then Darwin's friends, Lyle and Hooker, say, all right, we're going to have to publish this or otherwise you're going to be scooped and gazumped. It's notable that, you know, Wallace is up on the other side of the world and he doesn't have any money. He's got nothing to lose. Darwin's got a lot to lose. He's a very, very wealthy man who cares very, very deeply about what society thinks. So it takes these combinations of circumstances, you know, friends pushing him on, the danger of, you know, the novelty of his ideas being lost, and finally the bravery to publish everything in 1859 that gives us The Origin of Species. And while somebody like Richard Owen absolutely tears it to pieces anonymously in the press, a lot of the groundwork had actually been laid over the previous years, and Darwin's fears about being castigated and being cast out from polite society don't come to fruition.
So at what point do we, in this rapid changing intellectual world, is it no longer going to take immense bravery to put your head above the parapet and say, yeah, come off it? I mean, look, it's evolution, isn't it?
Well, although, as I mentioned at the beginning, the subtitle of the book involves the war between science and religion, this is not a warfare where there is a decisive battle after which, you know, religion loses, science wins. It's not that kind of fight. But what I do argue is that there is a point in the early 1880s where several incidents symbolize almost a concession of a place, an unyielding place in public life by religion to science. So first, Darwin dies. And for somebody who had feared ostracism by religion and society, he's buried in Westminster Abbey, only a few feet from James Usher. The second thing is the raising of two towers of science in South Kensington in Albertopolis. So we have Richard Owen's Natural History Museum, which, although we now regard today as his Palace of Science, was actually raised in the Paleolithic tradition of, you know, religion and science working together to understand the natural world. But in opposition to that, we have Thomas Huxley's Royal College of Science, which becomes Imperial College London. And it is founded and it's established and it goes through several different names as a means of creating a completely secular scientific profession, the members of which can pursue their investigations without ever worrying about religious dogma or religious criticism. And then somewhere else in London, at Westminster, we have the re-election to Parliament of the atheist Charles Bradlaugh. So Bradlaugh is a radical atheist, maybe the most famous atheist in the world. He had been prosecuted for obscenity and blasphemy and had tried to use Darwin as a character witness in the court. Darwin refused because he didn't want to be associated with somebody so notorious. But he stands as a liberal MP in the general election of 1881, and he is refused admission to the Houses of Parliament because he refused to swear a religious oath. He's actually imprisoned in Parliament because he then refuses to leave the chamber, having refused to take the oath. But he's sent back to Northampton for a by-election. He's re-elected. It happens again. He refuses the oath. He's sent away. He's re-elected again and again and again. And ultimately, by 1886, I think, the Speaker of the House of Commons just gives up and says, all right, you can swear a secular oath, you can affirm and take your place. So we have almost the last bastion of a completely religious state falling, not to science, not losing to science, but conceding a place to a secular way of thinking about the world, which science and secularism will not yield after that point.
So if I was going to push you, because we started this discussion with the notion of the person born in 1780 and 1830, lives to 1830. What's the lifespan? Are we looking somebody born in 1810, dies in 1890, not inconceivable, 80 years old? Would that be the sort of span we'd be looking at to say that person has gone through the most extraordinary intellectual, cultural, scientific shift?
I think so. You have a way of looking at the world and of understanding natural life in terms of natural selection and evolution, which is completely revolutionary. In terms of technology, you have telegraphs and the steamship and probably electricity in a lot of places by the 1890s. You have a great many more people being allowed to vote and atheists in the Houses of Parliament. The world has changed dramatically over the course of those 70 or 80 years. And I'm sure that if you looked at any period of 80 years, you could point to similar things. But I think in terms of completely revolutionizing the way that society and politics and thinking itself has changed, This is one of the most exciting and one of the most dramatic periods in human history. And we might look at the Victorian period and have this popular, but I think misguided conception of it being incredibly staid and prurient, but actually it's pretty radical.
Now, before I let you go, I just want to find out a little bit more about you and what's driven you, because I saw a quote that said, "I'm just living out a childhood dream of being able to read about dinosaurs." So is this something that the young Michael Taylor, aged 6, 7, we've talked to other historians like this, Tom Holland, for example, is another one who's absolutely obsessed with dinosaurs, and it comes from a sort of childlike awe. Did you develop this passion for dinosaurs as a child? And if so, why is it so gripping for children? You see so many children awestruck by dinosaurs.
Yeah, I'm very much a child of the Jurassic Park generation. So I was born in 88, so I was 5 whenever the film came out. I was 8 whenever I first saw it, which is whenever it was first broadcast on terrestrial TV. And I swooned at the sight of a dinosaur. I had plastic figurines all over the living room floor. I had these great big binders that I filled with dinosaur-based magazines. Even now, I still continue to watch all of the sequels to Jurassic Park, which, you know, to borrow a joke and to quote the original, are so bad that you think the producers are only wondering of whether they could rather than whether they should. But these are creatures of awesome beauty and brutality. They can be, you know, lovely and terrifying and, at the same moment. I'm not sure I've ever really been able to express exactly how or why I'm fascinated by them in the way that I do. But yeah, writing this book and writing about the intellectual processes which actually underpinned and informed the history of paleontology and the discovery of dinosaurs has been a great privilege. I've been paid to live out that childhood dream, and I'm very happy to have done so.
Facile and ridiculous question, though, this is. Do you have a favourite? A favourite dinosaur?
I can tell you ones that I still have nightmares about, but I'm not sure if I have a favourite one.
Intriguing. Now, the weird thing, lastly, is that you've appeared on a couple of very high-profile quiz shows. You've won University Challenge. You got to the final of Mastermind. But in looking through your specialist subjects, I don't find the 19th century prominent. I find, dare I say it, the four-letter word golf that appears, which is most upsetting to a man of my sensibilities. Why were you not drawn to go back into the 19th century or even to dinosaurs for your specialist subjects?
So this may be giving away a secret of the production of the show, and I apologize if so. You're not allowed to do anything either which has been done by a contestant within the previous 3 years, or any subject which you might have been paid to do in your professional life. So all history was off limits to me.
Oh, so cricket would be off for me. This is a disaster.
Yeah, well, I couldn't do cricket either because as a student, I'd been paid to work as a cricket journalist, so I wasn't allowed to do that either.
Oh, I see. This makes an enormous amount of sense now. So I think I'd have to probably do the 6-part so-called sitcom Whoops Apocalypse. That would be, I'd have to go down that line. On the subject of quizzing, because you do it a lot, what is it about it? Is the accumulation of knowledge, are you just somebody naturally for whom facts stick? Or is there a sort of competitive element to this? Because you've mentioned cricket, you did write about cricket, you did play cricket, you're a first-class cricketer at university.
A third-rate first-class cricketer, but...
Well, you know, that's for other people to judge. Is there a strong competitive streak? And I ask this partly because in the subject of the 19th century, the tension itself almost feels like it's a competition between the religious and the scientific. Is competition a large part of what drives you and inspires you?
I think so. I mean, with quizzes and people who do quizzes generally, I don't really have any time or any respect for people who just learn lists of things for the purposes of answering a question on a quiz show. I've never been able to do that. And I am completely rubbish and hopeless at any topics that don't interest me. So whenever we were on University Challenge, for instance, I was tasked with specializing in the 18th and 19th centuries. And that worked because I found it interesting. And rather than simply being able to recite answers from a list, I knew the stories behind them. I could answer the how and the why question. And that actually made it much, much easier to recall the specific fact that might have been demanded. The competition aspect is also there. But so is the element of teamwork. You know, one of the happiest periods of my life, I think, was probably at university over the several months that we were filming University Challenge, where I got on well with my teammates and we'd gather together and we'd practice and we'd read and we'd, you know, keep each other on our toes. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why I enjoy playing cricket so much. I mean, I don't think it's possible to enjoy cricket if you don't enjoy the company of your teammates, because you spend so long with them. It's a game where I think people more qualified than I have said that you're either failing or doing nothing 90% of the time. So you better find a way of enjoying that 90%. You know, I really like bowling. Occasionally I like batting, even though I haven't really had a net in about 7 years and have therefore lost the ability to bat. And I'm a terrible fielder. So if I just play for bowling alone, it's going to be a very, very lonely day.
It's failure or it's doing nothing. I think it's probably very appropriate that the only Nobel Prize winner to play first-class cricket is Samuel Beckett, because you've pretty much summed him up. Michael, it's been magnificent. Thank you so much for joining us on Inspired Minds.
Oh, thanks so much. It's been a privilege to be here.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Michael Taylor. His book, Impossible Monsters, Dinosaurs, Darwin, and the War Between Science and Religion, is available to buy. Go out and get it now. It's an absolutely fascinating read. And you can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. If you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.